Welcome to TechnoViews, a new series of interviews with major figures in humanities and social sciences on topics at the intersection between science, technology, and society in the 21st century. My name is Gonzalo Santos. I am an anthropologist of China, and I will be moderating this episode together with my colleague and fellow anthropologist, Jun Zhang. This episode will take us on a long journey into the history of the crops that have come to shape the modern world. We shall be discussing a wonderful book published in 2023 by Yale University Press that was recently awarded the Edelstein Prize by the Society for the History of Technology and the Bentley Book Prize by the World History Association. The book is entitled Moving Crops and the Scales of History, and was co-written by a dream team of historians of technology, including Francesca Bray, Barbara Hahn, John Bosco Ludusami, and Tiago Saraiva. The book is a bold attempt to redefine historical inquiry based on what the authors call the cropscape, the assemblage of people, places, creatures, technologies, and other elements that form around the crop. Through investigating a wide number of cropscapes spanning millennia and the globe, the authors break open traditional historical structures of period and geography to give new insights on previously invisible actors and forces. Well, let me welcome you, Tiago and John, to TechnoViews, and let me start with the basics here. Your book is about histories of crops. What prompted you to focus on crops? Is it a book about agricultural history?
Thank you, Gonzalo, for having us here. It's a great pleasure indeed to be here. And coming straight away to your question is indeed a book on agricultural history as it deals with crops. In fact, several of them, and covering several aspects of them. The modes of selection, cultivation, growth, decay, marketing, taste, recycling, trade, and over different periods of time and different locations. But it is also beyond agricultural history, as we have used crops to convey larger historiographical messages, particularly centered around movement and mobility. Hence the title, Moving Crops. With different crops as examples, there's a lot of movement in the book across space and time. In the process, we capture a range of movements of ideas, species, seeds, knowledge, laborers, entrepreneurs, and products. And we have taken particular care to see that these are not particular stereotyped kinds of movements, like linear, unidirectional movements, always from one particular state towards another supposedly exalted state or ideal, like small to big, simple to complex, primitive to modern. On the other hand, what we do is we consciously attempt to transcend such fixities and stereotypes. We try to capture the rich going back and forth, and most importantly, the network ways in which different factors, human and non-human, interact and root a particular crop in a particular time, in a particular place. It is this richness, complexity, and dynamic assemblage that we try to capture through the concept of cropscape. So yes, the book is about crops, and therefore it surely is agricultural history, but it's lots more than that, encompassing other fields like history of science, history of technology, economic history, and above all, it is a work of historiography.
Hi, John and Tiago. Thanks for coming. This is Jun. Recently, a friend of mine who is not in the academic world asked me to recommend an academic book for leisure reading. And I actually recommended your book, and I really love it. And I told him that the book is very readable to a non-specialist, and it's full of fascinating stories. And he looked at the cover and asked me, what is the so-called scales of history? So could you explain this concept and describe the main idea behind this book to a non-academic audience?
Thank you for this question, and particularly to your friend, which brings us to the second part of the title and very much related to the first part. So we talk about the scales of history. So first of all, it's plural. So it's the scales as opposed to a scale or the scale. So that already sends a clear message that there are different temporalities that need to be considered. Especially in relation to the first part of the title. Yes, we are interested in capturing different kinds of movements, but not within a fixed goalpost, or rather towards particular goalpost through particular prefixed temporality. As said already, there are a lot of movements we ourselves make throughout the book. And one of the important categories of such movements is the movement across times in such a way that even as we go forward to look at various factors surrounding the cultivation of dates, for instance, in the 20th century America, we find a sense in relating that crop in 20th century America to supposedly pre-modern methods and circumstances of the cultivation of the same crop in the Middle East millennia before. We assert that, again, for instance, the tulips cannot be seen just in reference to Amsterdam and to the particular time period, the way much of world history connects Amsterdam and tulips. Rather, there is a need to look at tulips only backward in time in terms of origin, but also forward, seeing how tulip goes back to Istanbul in different ways and contexts. Thus, we desist from putting crops or their movements in fixed time frames. So in that sense, we scale across time and go back and forth. In another sense of the subtitle, we are also interested in different stretches of time as the history of rise in a particular place over centuries and millennia, as also in the time that spans between the planting of a crop and the particular aspects of its growth or harvest or taste or value of its product. Over a period of days, weeks, or years. Thus, we attempt to make a historiographical point in terms of handling of and approach to one of the most central elements of history and writing of the whole history, which is time. So our first chapter, in fact, is fully dedicated to that aspect. So with regard to the message that this book tries to convey, in continuation of what was said in response to the previous question, we would like to highlight there is much merit in seeing crops as cropscapes, not only in terms of assemblages of various human and non-human factors and the play of various kinds of agencies, but also getting off the shackles of the established stereotype notions of temporality and directionality in time.
Well, the book mentioned many crops. Were there any criteria which crops to write about? Which story is your favorite and why?
I'll take this one. So thank you for the invitation to do this podcast. And also thank you, John, for already like introducing many of the things that are central to our project. And let me just add that this is a real project, a project that has friendship, that is friendship at the center, and that actually through the writing of our different stories, it's our own, we were weaving our own friendships together, the four authors here, and that makes it very hard to answer the question of choosing one crop, one favorite crop. And I have many there. Some of them that I actually liked, and I don't like them anymore after writing the book. But let me pick one that John has already mentioned, which is the date palm tree. And the date palm tree does lots of work for us. They did lots of work for us in this book. It's in the first chapter, one that in allows us to discuss issues of periodization. It makes clear the question of how we choose different crops. And how did we choose this one? Well, it it allows us to engage many different kinds of historiographies. And so, and historiography is one central aspect of the whole book, which is we are able to make a more general point when we pick up crops. If the crop doesn't do that, then you say, ah, it seems interesting, but it's set it aside. But with the, so with the case of the date palm tree, so it allowed us to go to follow a very long-term history since its domestication, till California in the 20th century, in the late 20th century, and forms of industrial agriculture. But it also, so it has this long span durée, but it also allowed us to actually challenge notions of what is modern and what is traditional, what is how do th what is old and new. And so we find issues like of early forms of capitalism, we might call them, in date palm tree oasis in the Sahara Desert. And we find very traditional things in the way that date palm trees are cultivated in California by the same kind of families, by a very localized story. And so it actually, it's a story that challenges how we think that, oh, everything always tends to get more modern. Things travel east to west, old to new, and the east is old, the west is new. It's and we do that also by engaging historians that are not just Western historians. And then we here we bring in a figure, Ibn Khaldun, the North African historian, that actually allows us, you know, to bring in new historiographies that are and authors that are normally not considered in these tales of agriculture and crops, that everything is getting bigger or getting more modern or getting more industrialized.
Well, if you have the option to add another crops or another regional time to the existing stories for crop, what would it be and why?
Oh, you have all the difficult questions, I see. So I'll take this one again, John. So, which, and this is, so we had many, many crops that we discussed, and as I said, some of them we left them aside, but maybe more than that, it's also there were decisions about and hard decisions about how to integrate the different crops in the book, meaning that there are crops that do show up in the book, so like barley shows up in several of our stories. But some of us, well, in this case, I can reveal. So Francesca Bray, in this case, like she was really, she felt it was a shame that we didn't include a long durée history of barley and its travels from west to east. A long durée history of barley starting in prehistory and ending in beer consumption in China nowadays. I have another case that I would also like to see it written in a different way, and maybe in the future we will do it. It's the manioc story. So manioc shows up in the book several times. It shows up in namely in histories that deal with cultural anthropology in the Amazon. And also in a chapter in the book that we called Compositions, that allows us to talk about how it's good to think about crops not in individual terms, but in assemblages, and that many times crops go together one with another. And in the case of manioc, for example, in Mozambique, that we can't speak of manioc just in isolated terms, but that there is a story there also of commodity production, and namely of cotton production in the 19th century. This said, so manioc shows up, but there is not like a one narrative that weaves all these cases together. And I would have loved to tell a history of manioc from the Amazon through Africa, then to East Asia. And that would allow us to see, I think, in very clear terms, South-South relations. We have a few of those stories, but South-South relations. And more than that, something that John also mentioned in his first answer of the different fields that we engage here with. Because to tell histories of manioc, we need to engage with fields of knowledge and and kind of scholarship that are not the usual ones for traditional histories of crops or agriculture, namely archaeology, anthropology, which I have already mentioned, and the history of technology. I think that would be a fantastic. So doing a whole riff just on manioc would have been a great decision, but this is for next time.
Wow, that's really interesting. As writers, we all know that in the process of writing, what data to present or what to be excluded is always a big challenge. I'm curious, among all the materials you had in your hand but did not include in the book, can you share with us one story or two that you would like to have in the book, other than the ones you have already just mentioned, but for some reason did not or could not edit to the book?
So we do have two cases where we have the entire story, the entire thing written, and then we just didn't include it in the book. And I think I can share these with you. These are so this goes a little bit further than just saying, oh, should we explore these or not? So these are cases where we actually wrote the whole thing, and then thought collectively, and this is all these were all decisions taken collectively, that they should not be part of the final manuscript. And so one is we actually had a title for it. We called it Pepper Empires. Pepper Empires, and so histories of pepper, they are as it's very obviously they have been objects of world history for a long time, and namely of histories of commodification, of spices, of going east to west, the formation of Western empires. And this is like the kind of things that we always make this cho that we always that how we always operate in how we go at these different crops. But they are also they for all these stories of Portuguese and Portuguese navigators bringing spices west, or and then later Dutch and British. But there has always been a huge market actually in East Asia for pepper, and that we should consider if we can center, we can decenter that story by telling it from China, from a Chinese perspective, and focusing on pepper in the Malacca Strait, and giving a total different geography of pepper than the one that we normally tell from pepper stories that focus on these east-west transfers. Another one, and don't ask me why we didn't include this one, because I think we should have included this one. But I'll tell you a little bit more about why we don't include. So is that the story is fantastic, and I think that it deserves a lot. There's many things for it on why we should have included it, but on the other hand, many of these historiographic points were already being made with other crops. And so this is like the difficulty of doing in taking the decisions. Then the other one about plant collectors or plant hunters of the 20th century of the United States Department of Agriculture going to the Middle East or going to East Asia, to China, namely, collecting plants. But while they are collecting plants, they also collect history. They just collect plants. They actually also collect stories, narratives. They do a little bit of ethnography. And in many cases, these plant hunters they turn themselves into historians. And so you see that in a book that deals so much with issues of historiography, that would be, this would be a case that would attract us on how people collecting plants actually turn into historians. This said, we felt that we didn't have enough detail to make a convincing case about this. And so we promised ourselves that we would write and we will do more research in a future article about this. But then the other, and then the other issue, why we didn't include this was we fear that, so we have insisted throughout the whole book in this historiography point, and that this one would be one, this case of the plant collectors as historians, that they might, this might be, it seems too abstract in a way, too abstract. But we will, or better said, we, and relating to what we just said, is that this, we still didn't have enough elements to make it like the juicy case that as it deserved, but it will show up in a later in later work, and I hope that it would show up also as a collective writing.
I have a question about a collective authorship. I mean, you mentioned several times in your responses friendship as the basis from which the whole book really started and how it got strengthened through the writing of the book. So, you know, multiple authors writing a single book is not really very common in the field of history. How did you come together other than friendship and decide to write the book together? Can you tell us a little bit the story of that? And what were the challenges in doing such a collaborative project?
Thanks for that particular question. So actually, it's not only we who cherish that aspect of this book. It now appears that almost all our reviewers, in fact, whatever I've read so far, there's a special mention in all the reviews about the joint authorship and the way we seem to talk in one voice. And in fact, that was one of the most probably some of the awards we are getting is also partly in recognition of that. To start with, so this project started in a very interesting way of all places in Albuquerque, in New Mexico, where we met for a session of the Society for the History of Technology, which has a lot of relations to our project. The short conference that year, 2015, and like many other things, it started over a glass of wine. But unlike other such cases where you have someone opposite the table or wine, so this was a different case. In fact, I was having wine, and a lady came and gently patted on my back. I guess you're John. Of course, it turned, and it turned out to be Francesca. Of course, I'm saying this for a reason, so people may wonder why I'm going into such minute aspects of it, but that's the spirit. So that's where that friendship, that kindness. And then she asked, would you be interested in a project on moving crops? I know that you worked on tea and how it had been moved, particularly India and within India. And of course, I was very happy to receive the invitation because I asked her, so very, how do you know me? And she said, no, I was there when you spoke last year at Dearborn, Michigan, the previous short conference. Again, I'm saying this not in terms of the minutiae of it, but that's been that kind of recognition because she was such a very senior person. In fact, she was the president-elect. She was going to be the president the next session. But that kindness, that kind of recognition, that willingness to evolve, and then she said, okay, fine. So in that case, we would meet the next day for lunch. So we have two others, Tiago and Barbara, and we also have the director of the Max Planck Institute of History of Science, who's Dagmar Schaffer, and we all met again. So this was properly over lunch. And we discussed, and you'll be surprised, in a matter of half an hour, we all agreed, and things fell in line. And 2016, summer, we started, and we have to be really grateful to the Max Planck Institute for having made this really possible, because what economic logic and other logistical logic would have dictated was having a set of people, say, for a stretch at 6 months, say, for 6 months at a stretch, and have a discussion, but you wouldn't believe it. So we met that on each occasion for just a week or 10 days, that almost every 3 months we were called. So it looked like really crazy, like coming once in 3 months just for a week. But that really worked wonders, because we went back, we mulled over what we had discussed, and we came back with a lot of food. And that was when I realized, because subsequently, we, of course, at that time itself, we knew the wonders of doing things online. Not as much as we did in COVID, but that even at that time these were available. But that was the time I realized for the first time in life there's always something special in meeting face to face as often as possible, however much maybe the blessings of doing things online, reducing the carbon print also. And this periodic meeting really helped until COVID came and interrupted in 2019. So these meetings, and especially we also had an academic coordinator there in the person of Elena Cuckoo, so who would take care of everything. So we were taken good care of in every way, academically, socially. And so there's that conviviality which really made it possible to discuss things over. And one of the things that we are proud of, and also a couple of reviewers also mentioned, is that the entire book was written by all of us. It's unlike other projects of multi-authored books where there are clear sections written by particular people, or it's a collection of essays or chapters. So this is a book where almost each section was written by all of us. Of course, each of us focused on particular crops, but all of us went through each case, and that's the reason why it looks like, although there are four of us, it's as well as being written by one person. So that really helped, that kind of being there periodically. Of course, to the other part of the question, so there's in everything else, there are also difficulties here, because we came from at least three different parts of the world with different time zones, and we were of different ages with different kinds of academic commitments, family commitments. So it was not always easy to find that set of days, a week or 10 days, once in 3 months. But we did well on that count also. And of course, one of the biggest challenges was COVID, which of course brought a halt for some time. But then we thought we would, as like the rest of the world, get going. Then we moved on to Skype, and so then we discovered the advantages of also doing things online. On the whole, I would say that there were difficulties, but we were able to tide over all of them, basically due to the hospitality provided by Max Planck, and of course, as Tiago repeatedly mentioned, the kind of friendship. So it was also a kind of self-discovery for us. It was not only academics, it was a new kind of a journey together. And so, as many reviewers have mentioned, I think this will also be a role model both for us and also for others to emulate. That was the best part of this journey.
Well, definitely, I hope your collaborative endeavor becomes a model for collaboration, for future collaborative projects by scholars in the humanities and social sciences. Let me thank you once again, John, Tiago, for coming to for being with us and agreeing to do this recording. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us here at TechnoViews. You just listened to an episode of TechnoViews, a new online platform broadcasting interviews with major humanities and social science scholars on topics at the intersection between science, technology, and society in the 21st century. TechnoViews is available on all major podcast platforms worldwide, as well as in the YouTube channel of the SciTech Asia International Research Network. Please check out our website, scitechasia.org, to sign up for our newsletter, and please visit our social media in Facebook, Instagram, X, and WeChat to keep updated with our latest events.